You are listening to a sermon by Connie Seeler, recorded on Sunday, July 19th, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So, good morning. It's a blessing to be here with you again and to look at the Word of the Lord together. And this time we're talking about 1 Timothy, today chapter 3, and as I understand, you've looked so far at chapter 1, talked about false teachers, then last week talked about the proper conduct at worship, and today we turn our attention to the character qualifications of leaders and the mystery of godliness. Thank you, Kevin, for splitting the chapter up into three parts. I find that very helpful because, as you can see, the chapter just naturally divides into those three sections, and this is also how I want to address them. But before that, I just would like to make some general remarks. There's different translations, and the NRSV that you are using says bishop. The NIV translates the same word as overseers, and another translation says church leaders. The other word in for deacons that is used sometimes is church helpers. So there's like it's kind of not that clear how to translate them. And that might be also because the differences are not really spelled out. The only difference really is that deacons don't teach and overseers or bishops are called to teach. In my sermon and as I prepared it, I used the word overseers that is here translated with bishops. And when I refer to both groups, I will say leaders, just to give you a heads up that there won't be any misunderstandings. It doesn't really matter which word we use, though. And, so the whole chapter is, again, directed against false teachers. Because Paul's aim seems to be to contrast the qualities of those who lead appropriately and correctly with those who do not. And Paul does this in a way that he does not define the responsibilities of the leaders, but he gives a character profile and not a job description. He concentrates on what church leaders ought to be and not what they ought to do. So his main concern is basically that he wants them to lead truly exemplary lives. And one thing that's also to be kept in mind is why we speak about those lists is that they echo Greco-Roman expectations. A lot of those qualifications that Paul lists reflect highest ideas of Hellenistic moral philosophy, and there's actually only one item on the list that's truly distinctly Christian. So let's now turn to the first list, and as I was preparing it, I was thinking, how can we talk about it in a way that's not like number one means this and this, number two means that and that, and so I thought I would make four or five observations about the text and just what Paul recommends. So there's first the overall qualification that's above reproach. And Paul uses this as a covering term for the following list. And he actually comes back at the very end in verse 7 to this. And we'll talk about it in a little bit. So there's the second observation is that Paul encourages those leaders to embrace virtues and to avoid vices. So there's especially three virtues he wants them to embrace, and that's to be temperate, self-controlled, and respectable, which means more than just stay away from alcohol. It means to live a life that's free of excess and or rashness. And he wants them to avoid drunkenness and violence, quarrel, so no gossip, and greed. I think with the greed, it's also good to know that this was something that was one of the sources why the false teachers fell, why it led them to ruin, because one of their deadly sins was greed. Another observation is that Paul encourages the leaders to faithfulness in marriage. As I see, the NRSV translates this with married only once, which gives it a different meaning than what the original text says. And the original text says that they must have only one wife. So, and this implies that marriage is actually assumed for church leaders. Today, this is, especially in the Catholic Church, not the case anymore. So this is another interesting thing that sticks out. And in this, Paul also wants to encourage them to lead an exemplary married life, to be faithful to this one wife they have chosen. This again is in contrast to a very low view of marriage that was held by the false teachers. The last observation is basically that there's some other qualifications that don't fall under one of those categories, like hospitable. Then we've already talked about able to teach, which means both the ability to teach the truth and to refute error. And then there's the last three qualifications, managing one's household well, spiritual maturity, and a good reputation with outsiders. Paul makes some more comments on those. Regarding managing one's household well, I think it's important to see that Paul does not only confine this to the household, to the people that are in the family, but he extends it to the whole church. And he implies both like guidance and caring concern. He also wants the person to be spiritually mature so that the person will not swell up with pride. And this is his concern for recent converts. And now, as I said, we come back to this covering term of above reproach. Is when he says a good reputation with outsiders, it reflects a genuine concern of Paul throughout his letters in the New Testament, and that is that he is concerned when a community's representative is disgraced, that the whole Christian community might suffer disgrace. So this summarizes the content of this first list again, and requires a church leader's behavior to be above reproach in the eyes of both God and society. So now, as we look at the next list, the qualifications of deacons, we see there are some differences and some similarities. Similar, for example, is that this above reproach is kind of like men of worthy of respect. Then they should be not double-tongued, literally, which is translated as, I think he is serious. In my translation, it says sincere. Again, they should abstain from wine and dishonest gain. Only be husband to one wife, manage the household well. So we've talked about those things. Those are similar, but then there is four differences. First, there's one item that's distinctly Christian. It says, keep hold of the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. Now, as we know from chapter 1, the false teachers in Ephesus have turned away from a clear conscience, and they have basically made shipwreck of the faith. So Paul encourages the leaders of the church, here in particular the deacons, to keep hold of the mystery of the faith and have a clear conscience. The word mystery is interesting because it's one of Paul's favorite words to describe the gospel throughout his letters. And when he says mystery, it can also be translated as revealed truth. And what Paul means is that what he has in mind is that the mystery of the faith was not something that was secret. It was rather once a truth hidden in God and now revealed by the Spirit. So that's why he says revealed truth, because this hidden thing in God is now revealed by the Spirit, and we know through the Spirit. The second difference is that the text says the deacons are to be tested before they should start service. He didn't say this for the overseers. So why test it? Well, we don't know. The text doesn't say. It doesn't give us any clue about the nature of this testing, by whom it was done, and what it looked like. All we know is that Paul had some testing in mind that had to be done first. A third difference is that he mentions women deacons or wives of deacons. And Andre already said something about this earlier, and I guess you have spoken about this before throughout the series about women and Paul. And, well, here Paul uses the word gynaikas in Greek, and this word can be translated as either women or wives. So we don't really know which one he means, and some scholars tend towards the translation of women deacons, such as Gordon Fee. Others, they tend more towards wives of deacons, and which way you translate it will also give a lot of, say a lot about how you see women in the church and their service there. But whether it's this one or the other one, there's four qualities that those women should have, and that's they should be dignified, not be malicious talkers, temperate, and faithful in all things. Now, the last difference is that in this section of the deacons, Paul also talks about a twofold reward for the deacons. This twofold reward is first that they will gain an excellent reputation within the community and before God, and second, that they will grow closer to Christ in both faith and personal assurance. So there's no material gain, but there's gain in Christ. Now, as Paul focused on living a godly life and the importance of living a godly life in those lists, he now comes in the third part in the purpose of the letter to emphasizing the importance of Christ and his church. And Paul makes two comments that underscore the importance of these instructions. In verse 15, he talks about the nature of the church, and he uses two images. He uses the image of a family as God's household, and then he talks about pillar, which refers to the picture of a temple. And in this way, Paul expresses two urgencies of this letter. That's first, his concern over proper behavior among believers in regard to the false teachers. And the second one is that the church, as the people of God, have been entrusted by God to uphold and proclaim the truth of the gospel. And the second comment that underscores the importance of these instructions is the mystery of godliness, Paul summarizes this mystery of godliness by using a fragment of an early Christian hymn. So verse 16 that we've just read, as you can see, is actually part of a Christian hymn. And the content of this hymn is very much centered on Christ. For example, it talks about appeared in my body, which affirms Christ's incarnation. He talks about his ascension as well, and his proclamation, he says, was preached among the nations, proclamation of Christ, and believed on in the world, which was the response to the proclamation. Also implied is Christ's resurrection and ascension and glory. And this purpose, this hymn and its purpose was probably at this point of the letter to again contrast the Christology of the false teachers. So whereas this has been all a bit more technical, I would like now to talk about how can this encourage us in our faith today? What can we take into our week from this passage? How can we apply it to our lives? Because maybe people think, well, you know, this is addressed to church leaders, but I'm a believer, I have some service in the church, but I'm not one who's on a committee or pastor. But I believe that there's two things that we can all take into our week, and that's first the importance of godly living, and second the importance of Christ. So regarding the importance of godly living, I think everybody, whether believer in a leading function or not, is encouraged to live a godly life. And in Paul's letters, we find this actually quite a lot. He says, for example, in Galatians, be careful how you live your life. And then in 1 Thessalonians, he says, live a life worthy of God. Now, 1 Timothy 3 refers to habits of life. And the question in this chapter deals with lifestyle and overall reputation. Yet there are still times when we fail in sin. So that tells us that the list is actually not duty-bound, but decision-bound, and needs to come from a heart that is set on God. The list, as we look at it, and those are good recommendations to live a godly life for each one of us, we can see that there's decisions to be made. We need to make the decision to say no to too much alcohol, no to gossip, no to join into gossip, no to see money as our God or other temptations. We need to say yes to one wife, one spouse, and no to more of those. And so we can see that it's really should come from a heart that's set on God and wants to make the right decisions. And as I've said before, is that Paul, he does not specify responsibilities. He gives a character profile and not a job description. So he talks about what church leaders ought to be and not what they ought to do. I think it is the same for us, that Paul encourages us in this way through this letter as well, to concentrate not on what we ought to do, but on what we ought to be, and live a godly life. So questions we can ask ourselves as today, are our hearts set on God? And do we aspire to live a godly life? And the reason, there's two reasons, I think, to aspire to live a godly life. First, there's to glorify God, and we've talked about this. A heart set on God, wanting to do His will, wanting to please Him, wanting to glorify Him in this world. And this is basically, if we look at it vertically. But then we can also look at it horizontally. That is the other people in this world. And the second reason for living a godly life, I think, is so that others may know Him too. It's... We might wonder, does it make a difference if we live a godly life, if people around us will see a difference? And I think it does. And I want to just tell you about one example in my life. That was years ago. I was in my hometown and in Augsburg, Germany. I did an internship in a children's hospital. So I was with the nurses, basically. And someone gave me instructions what to do, but then they just went about their way, most of the nurses. But there was one nurse who was different, who looked out after me, said, yeah, hey, explain to me what I can do and why I would do it this way, would invite me to join in and just watch certain activities, to join in when a child had to go to another place to get a CT scan or something else. And I just felt there was something different about this person, but I just thought, well, they're friendly. But then, 2 years later, I was invited to just a Christian gathering at my friend's place. And I walked in, and there was this person again, and I found out that they actually were a Christian. And I would never have thought that in the first place. So that's when I thought, oh, wow, yeah, it really does make a difference. And when I experienced it the other way around, not that I made a difference or my godly living made a difference, but that the godly living of someone else made a difference. I've also experienced it the other way around, because I play soccer on a team that is composed of mostly non-Christians. And I've been wondering, yeah, does it actually make a difference? There's not that many conversations about Christ. We've had some, but we get together, we play soccer, and, you know, we're friends, and we use the opportunities we get, but people are not that interested. Some are more, but most of them are not. And we do pray a lot for them, and we've seen some things happening. But I was wondering if actually just the way we live makes a difference. And then one of my friends said, there's 3 Christians on the team, including me. And once my friend said, yeah, I talked to Jen the other day, and she said, you know, she had a really bad view of Christians, but since she's known us, her view has changed, and her view is so much better of Christians now. So I thought, oh yeah, it does have an impact. And what God says, that he says his word will not come back empty. And so when we live a godly life, it will not come back without gain for God and his glorification. So that was the first application I think we can take from this passage, the importance of living a godly life. And the second one, I think, is the importance of Christ. We've just talked about the Christological hymn in Phase 16, and its message really centers on Christ, on the Christ who came to us, and the response he has received and deserves to receive further from us. As I said, there's proclamation of Christ in this hymn, and this proclamation of Christ that evokes a response. I still think that the proclamation of Christ evokes a response today from us as well as from everyone else. At first, when we enter the Christian life, the response is whether we are for him or against him. Christ says this himself, who is not for us is against us, in one of the Gospels. But I think there's still a response that we have, like the proclamation of Christ just from the pulpit, from in everyday living, reading our Bibles. This proclamation still evokes a response in our lives today and each day we live with Christ. Yet this response looks a little different. I think it's more the response to, are we open and willing to grow into a deeper life with him or not? Someone once said about marriage, you either grow closer to your partner or you grow apart. So there is no middle ground. And I'm not married, not yet, so. But I think with Christ it is true, at least. If we grow either closer to him or we get a little further apart. So, questions we can ask ourselves today and throughout this week is, we can look at what response Christ has received from us in the past and then ask us, what response does Christ evoke in me today and for this week? Another challenging question I find is also to ask, are there any obstacles such as stress, hidden sin, fear, displaced focus that hinder us today to respond to him in a deeper way? But I think it is worth to respond to him and to open our hearts towards a deeper life with him. So those are the two things I think that'd be good to take into our week and to even think about now.